Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nat Edwards, and I'd like to welcome you tonight to the National Library of Scotland for this evening's event. It's good to see everybody's braved the frost and the ice. I think you'll warm up quite soon this evening. It's very appropriate, I think, that the National Library of Scotland is hosting this very topical debate. This is a library which over the years has seen as one of its librarians, David Hume, one of Scotland's sort of foremost critics of thought and religious belief. We have just on the other side of the foyer there, you can go and look at the original letter written by Darwin proposing Origin of Species. The original letter is just there, a few yards away. You can go and have a look at it, to the publisher, John Murray III, who's on the wall just over there. You can also see Murray's editor's response, the Reverend Whitwell Elwin, and his response to the proposal, again, the letter, the first, if you like, critique of Darwin's idea. And so I think it's completely relevant that we're hosting the event tonight, and I'm sure everybody's going to enjoy it. Okay, I'd like to ask you to explain tonight's event and to introduce its chair. I'd like to welcome Juliet Wilson from the Humanist Society of Scotland, if you'd just like to welcome her. Cheers.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm the convener of the Edinburgh branch of the Humanist Society of Scotland, and welcome to our Darwin Day Eve event. This event's been organised with the Institute of Ideas and the National Library of Scotland, and I'd firstly like to give a sincere warm thank you to Duncan, Nat, Kenny and Sue from the library for all their enthusiasm and hard work in helping us put this evening together and giving us this lovely venue to host it in, and also to the Institute of Ideas for their support and Tiffany Jenkins for chairing the debate. We've got a diverse and interesting panel who will be introduced to you in a moment, but some of them have come from very far to be here today, and I'd like to thank them all for agreeing to take part. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the concept of humanism, let me give you a very quick introduction. Humanism is an ethical life stance which asserts that we can lead good lives without religion or superstition. And humanists are vitally concerned with issues that affect our world. We accept other people, whatever their race, creed, colour, age, gender or sexuality. The HSS is a secular organisation and we campaign for a secular state. More importantly, humanists think that we can only advance as a society and solve problems through discussion and debate. Therefore, we're very grateful for having events like this. But to introduce the debate, over creationism is one of the hottest flashpoints in the battle between secularism and religion. While the US has seen extended conflict over the theory of evolution, new challenges to Darwinism under the guise of intelligent design have arisen in the UK. Although the Royal Society and much of the scientific establishment has denounced the teaching of creationism, a recent Moray poll revealed that over 40% of the public believe that creationism or intelligent design should be taught alongside science in schools. Yet, if the UN Special Rapporteur on Religion and Belief is to be believed, two-thirds of the UK population have no religious belief. So there's obviously much to discuss. So without further ado, let me introduce you to your chair. Dr. Tiffany Jenkins is the Director of Arts and Society Programme at the Institute of Ideas. Tiffany is a cultural sociologist whose research explores the crisis of cultural authority in museum institutions. She's interested in the legitimacy of museum institutions, cultural policy, the body as a site of identity, and the symbolic meaning of dead bodies. She also writes and broadcasts on arts and related issues. Please give her a warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Everybody has to find their niche. Okay. The title of our debate this evening is Should Schools Teach Creationism? It's a very controversial discussion. We could go in a number of directions. We've got a very large and talented panel to take us there. I'm going to introduce them. They're each going to speak for 5 minutes, short and sharp. Afterwards, I'll put a few questions to them and get them to respond to each other. Then I'll go out to you. I'm really interested in what you think rather than a question and answer session, so we'll spend a fair amount of time going back and forth before they bring them in for their final remarks. So first to speak is on my far right. He's Alex McLennan. He's the founder and executive director of Reason Why, which is a Scottish Bible teaching and apologetics ministry. Second on my immediate right would be Christopher Brookmar. Christopher is an award-winning novelist and playwright. His most recent novel is Snowball in Hell. He is also the Honorary President of the Humanist Society in Scotland. We'll then hear from Dr. Mark Surtees. Mark is a biologist who spent many years examining the evidence related to the debate on evolution and creation. Mark is on the board of Manorfield School, Christian School in Edinburgh, and assisted in science teaching at the school for 1 year. He and his wife, Rosalind, run Paradigm Shift, which is a science and nature shop in Leithwalk. We'll then hear from Julian Baghini. Julian's already been writing about this debate in the Herald this week. He's a philosopher and he's a pretty prolific writer. His latest book, one of many, is Complaint from Minor Moans to Principled Protests. Then we'll have Dave Perks on my far left. Dave is head of physics at Graveney School in London. He's also the co-founder of the Physics Factory, which is a project to rejuvenate physics education in schools. So, Alex, if I can ask you to kick us off.
Some of the most enjoyable stories are those with the ability to spring a surprise. So, have you heard the one about the institution that refused open inquiry and forced a member to resign because he welcomed dialogue with students who disagreed with him? You may have something ecclesiastical in mind, but however, there's a surprise in store. In 2008, Michael Rice, the Royal Society's Director of Education, was put under enormous pressure by his peers to resign. Why? He openly encouraged science teachers to engage students on the question of creation. He said, "I realised that simply banging on about evolution and natural selection didn't lead some pupils to change their minds at all. There is much to be said for allowing students to raise any doubts they have, hardly a revolutionary idea in science teaching, and doing one's best to have a genuine discussion." Michael Rice reflects the traditional views of many science teachers, science textbooks, and scientists around the world, even fellows of the Royal Society who agreed with him. So the pressure to resign did spring a surprise. This was not the reaction of caricatured religious types from the Middle Ages. This was the Royal Society in the 21st century. What is it about creation that triggers such wrath? And why is the mere mention of creation in the science classroom context enough to froth a scientific frenzy? Is it really a mission to defend the good name of science and weed out the non-science or nonsense, as some would suggest? Dr. John Polkinghorne, a world-class physicist and member of the Royal Society, has defended the case for a creator. He spoke about the origin of the universe and said, "The theistic conclusion is not logically coercive, but it can claim serious consideration as an intellectually satisfying understanding of what would otherwise be unintelligible good fortune. This in no way seeks to be a rival to scientific explanation, but rather it aims to complement that explanation by setting it within a wider and more profound context of understanding." Polkinghorne helps us make sense of the problem by putting his finger on the pulse of the debate. It's not a question of science. It's a question of the context in which we do science. It's about worldviews. Clearly here, there are two competing worldviews: the belief there is a creator and the belief there is no creator. The belief there is no creator is not a scientific conclusion. It's a philosophical position. And every time a science teacher states the universe is ultimately the result of unguided forces, they subtly remove their white coat and put on a tweed jacket. Philosophy is the locus of the debate, and both sides deserve to be fairly represented. This is not about scientists jiggling a test tube. This is about scientists standing back and trying to paint the big picture. I recently picked up a few biology textbooks, and we could happily flip through them, every one of them, chapter after chapter, page after page, without much disagreement, until we land on the few pages that present the overarching theory, the big picture, the world view. Henry Schaefer III, one of the world's most distinguished chemists, awarded the London Royal Society of Chemistry's Centenary Medal, believes in a creator. And he defends the reasonableness of doing science within the context of this worldview. He has written to demonstrate that throughout history, he is not the only one. Francis Bacon, Kepler, Pascal, Newton, Faraday, Maxwell, and we could go on, because the list is long. Belief in a creator and presenting the case for a creator is not new in science. It's part of the history and foundation for doing science. It's why the Royal Society was established. Only recently has it been erased from textbooks and eradicated from the classroom. And this purging is not based on doing science. It's based on defending philosophical presuppositions. The debate is not about the mechanism. The debate is about whether or not you can have such a complex mechanism without a mechanic. Is the universe ultimately the product of guided or unguided forces? In the science classroom, whenever a science teacher or science textbook tries to paint the big picture, there are two sides to the debate, and students have a right to know. The classroom should be a forum for controversial issues and free inquiry, an atmosphere where students can breathe and grow, fairly present the issues, and trust students to make up their own minds about what theory is best supported by the evidence. Science is not threatened by creation, because creation does not threaten science. Creation threatens the worldview of some scientists, and some scientists don't like it. This is not a debate about science. This is a debate about worldviews in the science classroom. So when science teachers present the case for no creator, science teachers should present the case for a creator.
Thank you. Question, should creation be taught in schools? Absolutely. I think we have a lot to learn from trying to understand where we came from is a good way of learning about ourselves. Here's some of the creation myths that we could be teaching kids. The no creation story was that the world's always existed, as believed by the Jainists of India. The slain monster creation story, that the world was created from the parts of a slain monster, that's believed in the Greeks, Indo-Chinese, Africa, Korea, Sumero-Babylonians. Primordial parents creation story, that the world was created by the interaction of primordial parents. The sea creation story, there's a cosmic egg creation story, and there's of course the spoken edict creation story, which is that the world sprang into being at the command of a god. I think there's an awful lot to be learned from myths and from our understanding of them. One of my favourite writers is Neil Gaiman, the comic book graphic novel writer, and there's a great moment in one of his graphic novels where the Sandman, who's the king of dreams, is speaking to William Shakespeare, and he says, "Things need not have happened to be true. Tales and dreams are the shadow truths that will endure when mere facts are dust and ashes and forgot." We've got a lot to learn from myth, but I think we would do myth a disservice when we try and take myth into the science class. It's a bit like taking Macbeth into the history class. It's a poor text for teaching history, and it does a disservice to what that text can give us in other respects. But people would make the argument, as Alex just has, that there's two sides to the story, and certainly there is, but when it comes to science, so let me demonstrate. I'm just thinking if I can get a couple of names of people from the audience so that it's not so impersonal. Young chap right in the front row. What's your name?
Kareem.
Kareem, right, your name's Kareem, right. And lady beside you.
Anne,
okay, right, Anne. You're up for murder. Bad news, I'm afraid, okay? And I'm the prosecutor, right? And here's the basis of my prosecution. I'm going to show you that Kareem couldn't have done it because he's got an alibi, he's got no motive, and in fact he's got a debilitating twitch that means he can't actually hold the murder weapon, okay? So that's why it couldn't have been Kareem. Therefore, it was you, and you are going down. Is that fair?
No.
Why not?
It wasn't me.
Yep. But I've just shown you that it couldn't have been Kareem.
But that doesn't mean it had to be me.
I didn't make any case for why it was you. I only showed you a number of reasons for why it couldn't be Kareem. That is what happens with intelligent design in the classroom. Intelligent design is not a hypothesis. It is not a theory by any scientific definition. It is merely a collection of criticisms of evolution. And it works on what we call the logical fallacy of the false dichotomy, that if it's not A, then it must be B by default. If it wasn't Kareem, it must be Anne by default. So, the way that works is that if we criticise evolution, it must be God by default, without the advocates of intelligent design or creationism putting forward any positive evidence for their case. And the bad news for them also is if there was cast iron evidence, the famously J.B.S. Haldane said, in order to disprove evolution, if someone was to find a fossilised rabbit in the Precambrian, then that would instantly disprove the theory of evolution. And it would. That's why it's a falsifiable hypothesis. If, however, that fossilised rabbit was discovered and completely disproved evolution, that would be disproving the case against Kareem. It still wouldn't be offering any evidence to back up the case for intelligent design. You need to make a hypothesis, you need to present evidence for it, you can't just criticise the other. And The reason I think this shouldn't be done in classrooms is it's wholly impractical. How can you get a science teacher in a class to say, right, in the first half of the class we're going to teach intelligent design, in which the teacher is going to say, well, for instance, according to our point of view, there's a hole in the theory of evolution because if we came from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? And then after lunch, I'm going to put my evolution hat on and I'm going to tell you why that's a completely ignorant and fatuous argument. I'm going to show you why we can still have monkeys even though we're descended from monkeys. If you're interested in the answer to that, it's simply, for instance, Australians and Americans are from Europe. It's like saying if Australians and Americans are from Europe, why do we still have Europeans? So in that respect, I think it would, just to sum up, essentially I would say that it is utterly impractical and there is no solid case made. It is merely a body of criticism of the theory of evolution. And the theory of evolution ought to be criticised legitimately on scientific terms, but what annoys me about the attempts to put it into classrooms is that its proponents would purport that there are a number of questions that evolution cannot or has not answered, and in reality evolution almost always has. Either its proponents haven't bothered looking up the answers, or they're being a wee bit disingenuous and pretending that these answers don't exist. And if they're going to be disingenuous, I don't want them being disingenuous in my son's class at school.
Well, thank you, Christopher, especially because you said that we need to make the scientific case for, well, I'm going to argue the scientific case for creationism, and I want to say, yes, we should teach creationism in schools because the existence of a creator is a reasonable conclusion based on the available scientific evidence. I want to take first the origin of the universe. We all know the universe is expanding. Therefore, at one time, it was very compact. And if we extrapolate backwards, it must have been once infinitely compact. And according to the current cosmological theory, it was once a singularity, infinitely dense and infinitely small. And this singularity expanded at inconceivable speeds, equivalent to many times the speed of light. The whole thing began as a quantum fluctuation. But I want to ask the question, why did nothing become something? And I also want to ask the question, why does the universe have exactly the right conditions to produce atoms, molecules, stars, planets, and people? The anthropic principle states that the universe has the right conditions because we are only going to be in a universe that has the right conditions, and that's perfectly correct. However, without a creator, it is difficult to see how a universe actually came to exist. The most popular solution is there are an infinite number of universes, the multiverse theory. But furthermore, the anthropic principle, though, requires not just an infinite number of universes, but an infinite number of different universes. So what we need is a mechanism for producing an infinite number of infinitely varying universes so that we actually can exist. And my question is, what is the explanation, what is the mechanism for producing an infinite number of infinitely variable universes? And I would like to argue that the most parsimonious explanation is actually a divine creator. Otherwise, you end up with an infinite regress, which doesn't explain anything. The second question I'd like to ask is about the origin of life. All experiments done to date show that there's no route from chemistry to biology. I want to ask the question is, where do proteins and nucleic acids come from? The very famous Miller-Urey experiment, which is in many of our textbooks, is proposed to be a solution to this problem, but they often fail to point out many of the problems inherent in the answer. The result of these experiments is actually a racemic mixture of chemicals. But the proteins found in living things is not a racemic mixture. It's actually, there's no mechanism known to produce the very specific structure of the protein from a racemic mixture of amino acids. Also, there's no natural mechanism to produce the nucleotides that are needed to create a DNA and RNA. Darwin actually started with the first cell, which is an assumption that might have been reasonable 150 years ago, but today it is a massive assumption given what we know about the complexity of the cell. Which brings me on to what Darwin gave us. I want to ask a third question about the diversity of life. Darwin actually explained to us how natural selection, the survival of the fittest, exists and what it can do. And I actually accept natural selection, a very good theory that explains an awful lot of biology, which together with population genetics, mutation, gene flow, genetic drift, have been combined into the modern synthesis, which explains much of biology.
But there's one thing it doesn't explain. It doesn't explain the arrival of the fittest. And there are many failures of evolutionary thinking. And one, just one example of something that was not predicted by the evolutions, which has actually occurred, is when we look at the fossil record. We look at the Cambrian explosion, the sudden appearance of many major phyla in the fossil record, major types of animal in the fossil record. There are no transitional fossils showing how we get from a single common ancestor to all the different phyla that appeared in the Cambrian. There is no explanation as to why all these phyla would appear at the same time, when evolution predicts slow, gradual appearance of different types of animals. And now we have molecular biology, which has really expanded in the last 50 years, revealing to us the fantastic complexity of the cell. Chance and necessity are not a sufficient explanation. It can produce order, but this order that it produces is regular and repetitive, not non-random and specific, like the code you need to manufacture a protein. DNA carries a code. The message requires a messenger. Where does the information come from? And more importantly, we need to remember that genes are only instructions for making the cell, the building blocks, if you like, the cogs and the wheels that make the cell work. There's actually another level of complexity, the so-called non-coding DNA, which controls the genes. And then there's an even higher level of complexity because we find the same switches and the same genes in different types of creatures, and we need an explanation for how that works. Natural selection is not a sufficient explanation for this because it does not produce anything new. It only produces variation on a theme. What is the mechanism to produce new bodies or new features like jaws, fins, limbs, and wings? Natural selection can only select what is there. It cannot produce anything new. So what we know about biology is actually consistent with the thesis that there is a creator. Just to conclude, what we know about the cosmos, what we know about life, what we know about biology, revealed to us by science, shows that it was not caused by the laws of physics and chemistry. There are many failures of the evolutionary paradigm to provide a sufficient explanation for the evidence. All that we have learned in the last 50 years is consistent with the thesis that there is a creator. The creator is actually a rational alternative, and we need a paradigm shift to allow this alternative hypothesis to be taught in our schools.
Thank you, Mark. Perfect timing again. Julian.
There are so many strands to this debate, and it's very difficult to sort of untangle them. But I think one of them is following up a bit on what Alex was saying, really. So much of what we hear about the case for intelligent design and for creation, there's quite a lot which I think has been said which is true. For example, that biology, everything we know about biology is not inconsistent with the existence of a creator. That there are certain problems with the theory of evolution, although actually, if you even saw David Attenborough's programme the other day, you could see he can explain in 2 or 3 minutes, in layman's terms, why a lot of these apparently intractable problems are not no such thing. So, for example, you often hear the example given by ID theorists that the human eye could not have evolved because, you know, it only works if it's all together. Attenborough basically explained why that wasn't true in about 3 minutes. But, you know, there are gaps, there are things we don't understand, the origin of the universe, etc. But the question is, you know, if there are these things we don't understand, and if there are things which are consistent with the existence of a creator, does that mean the existence of a creator is therefore a scientific hypothesis? And it isn't really, which is what I think, you know, Alex was saying at the beginning, that he said quite openly that this is not a debate about science, but about worldviews. I think that's true. There is no real science in ideal creationism. So if we're talking about the teaching of science, as it were, the body of scientific knowledge, there just is no room for it in this. And I would argue perhaps later in discussion if someone feels the need to back that up. But does that mean, therefore, that there is no talk about the existence of creators and these competing worldviews in schools? And that, I think, obviously not. I think it's a very good thing to discuss these things. It's just evidently the case that a lot of intelligent people, including people who are top physicists and biologists and so forth, do believe in some kind of God, and often a creator God. Has to be said that there's a lot of evidence that belief in such things tends to diminish with higher education and so forth. The population as a whole, as a survey mentioned earlier, amongst the population as a whole, a lot more people believe in some form of intelligent design or creation than do among the scientific community. But nevertheless, it's not. It's possible to be a very intelligent, learned person and still believe in a creator God and so forth. So clearly these are live hypotheses in society, no matter how baffling it may seem to certain atheists and so forth, that these things persist. So we need to talk about them. Not in science as it is currently taught. I kind of think that it's quite good to have a kind of what you might call science studies in some form. I mentioned the Herald column, if you read it, that there's a wonderful course in the A and AS levels, as they have in England and Wales, called Perspectives on Science. It looks at a lot of the issues around the sociology of science, history of science, philosophy of science, relationship between science and religion. I think these are really interesting debates. I think they should be had. I think it's a bit of a limitation at the moment that the only kind of science teaching we get at schools is simply, as it were, the content of science and nothing about the framework and context in which it exists. So I'm all for that. But, you know, one has to be careful not to grant too much here. And this is where the line in the sand, if we are to draw one, because we could agree with so much here, is that there's just no way in which we can accept that ID or creationism are scientific hypotheses with any credibility whatsoever. And there are lots of reasons for this. I mean, we could get into a debate about detail, but I think a telling fact is simply if you look at who believes these things or not. On the evolution side, you find that scientists of all kind of persuasion, religious or otherwise, believe in the case for evolution on the basis of evidence and so forth. On the intelligent design side, you find that, you know, 99% of people who believe this already have a very strong, not just a strong religious conviction, but actually often a very strong commitment to the sacredness of the Bible and the truth of its teachings. And I think, you know, you can see their motivated reasoning, as psychologists call it, absolutely in force. So, I mean, that's not the whole, the case doesn't rest on that, but I think that's just one very, very clear bit of evidence which would be foolish to ignore. So I say, yeah, let's talk about these things, let's talk about competing worldviews, let's not pretend that it's intellectually disreputable to believe that there's some kind of creator. It isn't, I'm afraid. I think it's wrong, but it's not intellectually disreputable. But we have to be very sure that we don't confuse that kind of diversity tolerance, let a thousand flowers bloom, we don't confuse that with the view that there's actually any kind of serious disagreement within science itself about whether creationism or ID is a scientific theory.
Thank you, Julian. And Dave.
I must admit, I'm getting a bit confused by the debate on the panel so far. I think
that's not meant to happen. You're meant to clear it all up.
No, but religion seems to be winning hands down at the moment. We seem to be a bit defensive, those of us who would purport to defend science. But then, you know, I think Juliet mentioned at the beginning the surveys that have been done recently about attitudes to evolution, and the Rescuing Darwin survey done very recently pointed out that only 25% of Britons firmly believe in Darwin's theory of evolution. And in the States, they seem to have a figure of 40% believing in evolution. You know, you can judge these as you like, but what it seems to me, instead of teaching creationism, why don't we argue about teaching some science? It seems to be a little bit missing. And, you know, you could then say, well, do we need a crusade for science and the theory of evolution? And you get the image of more battle buses going around with stickers on saying, God probably doesn't exist, so you can feel happy about it, or whatever. But, you know, I'm not really in that kind of ilk, and I think that scaremongering about the rise of creationism or fundamentalist religious views isn't really the point. The point is that there's a decline of belief in evolution, yes, but it's the decline in belief that's the point, not about evolution per se. You know, even if you look at the religious sort of side of the argument. In the Times, Cormac Murphy O'Connor, I think it was last week, made the point that the fundamental question we're addressing is the question of meaning and purpose. And I think he's right. You know, he says, are humans only to be comprehended in purely materialistic ways? And there's a point to this. The point is that banging on about evolution or scientific understanding as the only world, you know, way of understanding the world, has a bit of a hollow ring to it, especially when you're talking to young people who are desperately seeking a way of understanding themselves and the world around them. And so when faced with Dawkins' certainty that we're just programmed gene carriers carrying out evolution's sort of diktats, then it's no surprise that the religious side of the argument has a little bit of an appeal to it. The appeal of spirituality, etc., that's something else about human beings. And I think if we're not careful, we can get caught in this sort of crass materialism versus religion kind of argument and miss the point that really what's happening is that neither side has a very strong purchase on the popular imagination at the moment. Religion certainly can't claim to be in the ascendancy. You know, the people are not flocking to the altar in any sense or shape or form, even though they might say they don't agree with the Dawkins kind of perspective. But you know, if you look into at the sort of the American case for creationism and ideas being, you know, that's where it's come from, that's the problem, it's coming over here, and that's why, you know, Dawkins wrote his book, The God Delusion, etc., and saying basically we need to stand up and fight that. But that's a complete kind of mistake in the sense that the way we understand what's happened in the States is not that creationism's on the rise, it's actually the opposite. It's having an embattled defeat after defeat in trying to get its message across. It was only a couple of years ago in the Dover, Pennsylvania case where the intelligent design lobby was virtually annihilated in terms of their argument to try and get their point of view put across into schools in the States because they completely lost the argument. And then if you look at what they're doing, which was very clearly put across, I think, by Chris, it's like, Alex, sorry, saying that what they're doing is arguing on the terrain of science, not on the terrain of faith, which it should be. If you're religious, that's the point, I would have thought. And so what they're trying to do is find the holes in science to then claim uncertainty and then say that that demands debate. About what? About the science? Well, obviously not, because that's not the point of what they're after. But that is, in a sense, the real problem when it comes to the opposing view. So if you look at the argument about what we should teach in schools, I quite strongly disagree with the views put forward, that this is not about sort of saying that we should have a rational debate in schools about particular worldviews and let kids decide for themselves and all the rest of it. This is about undermining the basis of science, scientific approach to education, on essentially a secular sort of a critique of science, because it is the critique of science as a certain body of knowledge that is being brought into schools. You don't need your philosophy of science lessons to be brought in. They're already there. In fact, you know, if you take Darwinian evolution at GCSE these days, you teach it with Lamarckian viewpoints alongside as a kind of critique. And if you know about that, then that's, you know, a very, very crass idea that if you have an idea, you'll pass it on in your genes. So good ideas will come out in those people's families that have them. And this is in a GCSE exam. These are what kids are having to learn. And teachers are having to teach. But why? Because we're obsessed with the idea that we should be critiquing the basis of science, critiquing how science is created, rather than teaching science itself. That idea is already there. It's built in. And so it's no surprise that the ID movement is latched onto it. And they're using that as a way to try and say, well, yeah, now put our idea in there as well, because it's already been done. So I go back to what I said at the beginning, that we might do ourselves a favour if we said, well, why don't we just teach them science and stop trying to teach all these critiques, which you can't really do in a classroom anyway.
Thank you, Dave.
I mean, there's certain levels of agreement and disagreement here, and I'd like to keep coming back to the fact that I am fully in support of teaching science in the science classroom. And whenever I am advocating that they should teach the case for a creator in a science classroom, but only at the points where they're teaching a case for no creator. So whenever science steps across that line, if you like, into the realm of philosophy to give a position that is not a scientific hypothesis, at those points, that's when I think it's only fair to represent another position.
When you would imagine, under what circumstances you could imagine a science teacher in a Scottish secondary school, under what circumstances they would say something that would explicitly imply the lack of a creator?
Good. I've got about five or six here, so. Yeah, one would be, for example, whenever science talks about that the universe came from nothing. Now, last week I got a friend of mine sent me an email. His daughter goes to primary school, and she came home from primary school and said, you know, listen what we learned today. The universe came from nothing. That's what she learned in primary school classroom. A friend of mine's a high school biology teacher. He was showing a DVD in his high school biology classroom last term. The DVD, you press play and it starts. In the beginning, there was nothing. And then there's a huge explosion and goes on to talk about the universe. So those statements are not scientific, they're philosophical.
Isn't that the religious position
as well? That in the beginning there was nothing?
No. If there was how do you get something from nothing?
Well, you're saying that there's a creator. A creator God would have had to come from nothing in order to create.
No.
Okay, let me take. You've spoken, Dave,
so
and then
really
Alex.
Point. You don't understand what nothing is. If you know a bit of physics, nothing is not nothing. It's things emerging in and out
nothing
of existence.
Is not nothing. Well, that's kind of confusing to the
well,
kids.
Well, learn some physics. That's
no,
what I'm
saying. No, why don't you clarify the definitions?
Well, matter can emerge in form of matter and antimatter over a short time due to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And that's been done, right? That's in the textbooks. Right? So, I mean, you're dealing with something on yourself on a bad philosophical basis, right? And if you want to do this, then please feel free, but at least go and study the science a bit better than that.
A bit better? Well, hang on, let me respond. So what is your view about where the universe came from, the origin of the universe? If it began to exist, what caused it to begin to exist?
I don't claim to know that, and science wouldn't claim to know that,
well,
because there are problems that science can't answer, and this is what I think I was trying to say. And I would say it's stupid to try and answer that. Right? Now, you might therefore say, science can't answer it, so put God there. Fine, if you want to do that, that's fine. But there are
why
plenty
is it,
of places
why is it stupid to try and answer the question?
Well, how can you do
if
it?
You don't like
if
the question, you can't dismiss it as stupid.
In a point which is a discontinuity, by definition, you cannot know before that discontinuity. That's fact.
You can know not temporally, but logically you can ask the question. It's not a temporal.
No, no.
It's not what comes. No,
bring,
you're missing the point.
I'm going to bring in Mark, and then I'm going to bring in Julian.
Thank you. I'm going to side with Alex on this one. I'll put Alex on this one because, quantum fluctuations occur. A vacuum is full of quantum fluctuations. Great. So we can have positrons and electrons which annihilate each other. Great. That's science. That's pretty solid. But then if you have a quantum fluctuation where a positron and electron appears and annihilates each other, where does the universe come from? That doesn't explain for me why we have all the complexity. How does that simple quantum fluctuation produce the universe with all the fine-tuning that we observe?
You're asking me a question.
Well, yeah, sort of. I'm asking a general question, if you like. But, yeah, so physicist.
Yeah, look, if you want a sort of lecture on particle physics and cosmology, then we can do that. But I think it's an inappropriate place to do it.
Probably,
but if you look at the satellites going up at the moment, the COBE satellite, Cosmic Observation Background Emissions satellite, was looking at the fluctuations that then led to the potential galaxies formation. The science is pretty damn good. And the point is that we know so much about something that seems so difficult to comprehend. That's the amazing thing.
Yes,
and way we should understand science is not the gaps that, there are gaps, so therefore science must be wrong. It's the point is, this is a project that humanity has been on for hundreds of years, and we have got a hell of a long way. We're not finished, but that's every problem you get. That's a challenge to a scientist or to scientists or to society to go out and solve it. That's the way you take it. Just turn it round. Stop saying that we can't and start saying we can. And then you don't have your problem.
Julian.
Well, I mean, I would agree that, you know, the science textbook shouldn't be making sort of metaphysical claims which go beyond science. But I don't think they do. For example, if you go back to the Big Bang thing, my physics is fairly ropey. But the extent to which a class in physics is going to say, for example, that time and space did not exist before the Big Bang, it only does so on the basis of very rigorous physics based on, you know, equations, research, etc. It doesn't go into any, it shouldn't, and I don't think does go into any greater claims that, you know, that there is no divinity or something. That's just not a part of the curriculum. But and every time you do, if you try and say at any stage that the explanation of the gaps, and we're back to that again, it is very God of the gaps stuff, it is sort of like reasonable to think that it is a intelligent creator or so forth. Well, first of all, that is its philosophy and it's not science. But two, it's a very bad philosophy. As David Hume, great Scotsman, said, argued, he made that before there was even any theory of evolution. He had this down to a T. The fact of the matter is, you can only make hypotheses about what happens in the physical world based upon the observation, experiment of what goes on in the physical world. And when it comes to these very fundamental questions, origins of life, origins of the universe, we have no idea. It is simple anthropomorphism to suppose that because the best thing we can imagine is some kind of conscious designer, that it is a conscious designer. That because to us, the best analogy we can think of for the universe is some kind of, like, you know, a clockwork mechanism or some forth, that it needs a divine watchmaker. This is just not science at all. And, you know, Hume could argue with that without going to any of the technical debates that came later. And we should be able to see that basic point now.
Okay, I want to ask one more question before I go out to you, which is, Julian suggested something along the lines of science studies, where you looked at perhaps different views on science, which maybe might be a place for creationism or ID. What do people think about that? Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for studying the philosophy. And I mean, there was an article that Dave has written, and he touches on something which I thought was quite interesting, where he talks about a response, the fact that the Discovery Institute, talking about the USA and others in the USA, are actively promoting an attack on science and its materialist philosophy should not scare us. Now, I'm not arguing about the science. I'm arguing about the materialist philosophy. Now, that is a method that you assume in order to do science. And that is a method. It's methodological naturalism. It's not necessary for doing science, because many scientists who do not hold that philosophical position, they do the same science. They sit beside you, they'll do the same science, but it's the context within which they do science. When you refer to the science that you're doing and you bring in that philosophy, at that point, there are other scientists historically and today who have a different worldview, and that worldview deserves to be represented. It doesn't impact the science, it impacts the context in which you do science.
They have a different worldview, but they don't have a different means of practice, you know, because science, we think of often making the mistake of thinking of science as a body of knowledge, when science is in fact merely a method. So it doesn't really matter what you believe while you're practicing science, as long as you don't allow those beliefs to prejudice your observations and your deductions from that. But it's I don't think that it's any kind of evidence that there's a reason to change how we practice science, or that to make out that a purely materialist perspective is in some way prejudicial, because science is about the study of the natural world, of what we can observe and what we can infer.
Yeah, I'd like to come back on that, actually, science science is a method, but today science is defined in such a way that anything, only nature is allowed. It's only matter and energy are the only sufficient explanations for everything we have. Now, that is restrictive, whereas we're arguing, I think, Alec and myself, that we should open that wide and say, why cannot we allow a supernatural explanation for something we observe? Why is that prohibited just because science is defined as nature only? Well, it didn't used to be nature only. When Newton studied science, he said he was thinking God's thoughts after him. Now, why is that not a good scientific method?
Dave.
God's thoughts, because he was working out what God must have done if he existed. That's great. So if God existed, I've cracked it. So I am God. That's the point. Okay? And, you know, Stephen Hawking's the same thing. The fact is that we have worked out the mind of God. So who needs God? Right? So it's like, I just, you know, your argument doesn't stand up. But the point about materialist philosophy, I think, is a sort of kind of a bit disingenuous, because I would turn it around the other way and say that for everybody who has faith and who deals in science, somewhere along the line they make a compromise where my beliefs and my understanding of science can't mix. And this is a really important thing. And this is kind of where I kind of respect what Michael Rice was on about, because I teach a lot of Muslim children, and they do science. They like science a lot culturally because they want professions, engineers, doctors and the rest of it. But they come up against the fact that their Muslim teaching, their teaching of their religion, is, you know, says one thing and science says another. And they literally ask me, what do you think, sir? Right? And I have to tell them, you have to decide where you draw this line, because you cannot have your abhorrence of evolution and study biology at the same time. So you decide where it is you draw the line. And similarly, if you want to put God in before the Big Bang, that's fine by me. But you, at least you have to accept that what we've understood by science and cosmology is what we're studying. And that's the dilemma that I think that people have. And it's quite possible to be a scientist and to have faith, because you as a person, as an individual, draw the line somewhere yourself. But you can't tell someone where to do that. And I would never do it.
People who hold that there is no God, equally, they will have to decide where they draw the line. And they will look at certain things that may lead them to conclude that perhaps there is something beyond this. Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchman, he says, when you first look at biology, it looks like you're looking at things that have been designed for a reason, but obviously he doesn't hold that position. So there's a reaction, and your worldview will determine where you draw the line, whether you choose to accept that conclusion or not. So again, what you've said to me, I can turn around again. So it's on these issues of philosophy. Wherever one view is presented, present the other view. You do the science. As I said, these science textbooks, you flip through page after page, and there's no disagreement.
I'm going to take Julian, and then I'm going to take the audience. You will have many times to come back, but I do have to get them in.
To that point,
go on.
It was just to say, if there's two points of view, would it therefore be fair to say that when we're teaching history of the Second World War, we should teach the Holocaust denial version alongside the version that we normally get taught, because these are two points of view, these are two, we call into question how we're teaching history by doing so? Or is it the case that one of these is entirely supported by evidence and the other isn't?
How many people statistically respond, you know, for belief in God, for example?
A couple of brief things. First of all, the worldview point. Of course your worldview affects how you see things, but on this particular issue we can see quite clearly, as I mentioned earlier, that people with a religious worldview and people with a non-religious worldview seem to be capable of looking at the facts together and deciding evolution is true and so forth. It's only people who have the religious worldview who seem to reach the opposite conclusion. So that's one case where the influence of the worldview is not symmetrical. And this goes to the second point, which I want to stress, this thing about my desire to teach science studies. Please God, not, well, please God, who isn't not there, not there. Who's probably not there. Thank you. You know, not in this kind of like, well, some people think this, so some people think that. What do you think, kids? Kind of thing. You know, that's awful. You teach different debates. You don't have to sort of pretend everything's balanced. So that's the first thing there. But then going back to this point, why not the supernatural? Why can't the supernatural be part of science? Well, you know, it can in a way. I think it would be bad. I think some people do make the mistake sometimes of saying that, you know, you can't, anything which postulates forces which are currently not understood by science or outside science can't be science. That's too restrictive. But then if you want those things done, you have to show they're there. So, for example, if you believe in extrasensory perception or things like that, if you could do experiments which show they're real, then that's fine. If you believe that homeopathy works through strange effects and you can show that through tests, that's fine. If you think that God is, supernatural forces are intervening, do the test, that's fine. The only thing I'd say is that every time someone has attempted to do such tests, so far they've always ended in complete failure, which should at least give us some indication of where we should prioritise our research funding. But sure, you know, do not rule out, it obviously would be ideological to rule out completely the possibility that forces are at work in this universe which are outside the current remit of science. We're not saying that.
I've got a man here. We've got a microphone. You'll notice we're being filmed. We're very lucky. Someone is going to put it on the internet for us afterwards, so please speak into the mic.
I'm W. Tehrani from Humanist Society of Scotland, originally from Iran and originally Muslim. The question I have is a layman's question. When we talk about teaching creationism at schools, are we talking about teaching the divine creator who sent Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and some other thousands of statues in India to represent him. And is that we are going to teach children about the divine creator who brings hurricanes, earthquakes, bushfires, and creates a lot of disaster for people, and states that we are doing this to you because your parents and ancestors have sinned. Is that, are we going to teach about the divine creator who sends rules to people how to live, how many wives to marry? A creator who says women are worth half the men. A creator who appears in form of statues, of wooden statues and stones in India. Are we going to teach about those? If the answer is no, we are not going to teach about that sort of divine creator. And the divine creator is not really divine. There is a creator who is natural, material, physical. Then I have no problem teaching about material origin of the universe. I have no problem. But if you are going to teach about the divine creator who had those properties that I listed, then I would say we should not teach, we should not even tell them that, oh, you can make your mind the way it is. I would bring to them all the facts of both sides of religion and atheist and give the weakness and strength of each and tell them why the divine creator does not exist.
Okay, can I see who else? Yes, we'll go to you and then we'll go to you. So if you go next.
Been raised is what's wrong with belief in a creator in scientific methodology? And I would suggest that the answer to that is falsifiability. We heard the point about if the fossil rabbit was found in the Precambrian, okay, evolution's wrong. Can the creationists or the intelligent design people point to something and say, if that was found, okay, then we admit we're wrong? If they can't do that, it seems to me it isn't science, and it could be taught as part of religious studies or world myth or something, but it isn't actually science. I suspect that creationism has been suborned by the prestige of science. It's trying to take a view which isn't actually scientific and get it accepted as science because then it thinks it will get more prestige. And I suspect that that actually is behaving in bad faith. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Then I'll come to you, and then I'll come to you.
I'd like to say just a few words about the notion of the world view. I read a book a few years ago, an old book called by Tillia, called The Elizabethan Worldview, which gave descriptions of the Elizabethan view of the spheres and so on. Now, much of that has since been discredited. We no longer have that kind of worldview. But the point is that the Elizabethans, because they couldn't explain things in scientific terms, resorted to metaphor. My point is that there are still a lot of things that we don't understand. And religion becomes the metaphor. And it should be taken in that kind of view, that we make the distinction about the things that we teach our children that are provable, but that we use metaphor to explain what we don't yet know. And that's everything from through the myths, the pre-Christian, the Roman stories, that are all very interesting, but they're metaphor for things that we don't understand. And if we progress and we actually substitute or we learn more that we can prove, then metaphor actually diminishes, and we should be striving toward really the eradication of religion, because that metaphor is actually a substitute or something that fills in by our own ignorance.
Okay, I've got two people here. I've seen you, but what I'm going to do is after I take these two, I'm going to have one sentence from each panellist. One sentence. And then I'll go back to you, sir.
My name's Archie McIntyre, a member of the Humanist Society of Scotland. I'm trying to imagine how creationism is taught in school. Presumably a teacher will say to the children, God created all these planets and stars and everything, and he allowed a meteor to come and land in the Gulf of Mexico and destroy all the millions of dinosaurs that he so painstakingly created. Then he allowed all evolution, and he allowed the human beings to be created, and he sat and watched them destroying millions of each other, killing them, terrible slaughter. And then he'll go on to say, and that was, by the way, that was designed, and also it is intelligent. Now, my question is, at what point did the intelligent designer stop using his intelligence?
Yes, and there's a gentleman in front of you, and then I'll come back to the panel for one sentence and then go to you.
Well, I'm a mathematical physicist primarily, but I'm also a little bit of a philosopher and a little bit of a biologist, so I have questions along those three axes. The philosophical question is, if we have to accept a creator of the universe, why suppose that it's God? Why can't it be a devil or an alien or something we don't know about? The biology dimension is back to Dr. Surtees' remark, which you start with a premise and he explains his premise. You're teaching this to kids in school who are logical, and the thing about science is you start with a premise and then you deduce a consequence. A direct consequence of what Dr. Surtees said is that vaccination does not work. The mathematical physicist aspect relates to his website, where Professor Andy McIntosh, who's a thermodynamicist. I'm a thermodynamicist. I work in the nuclear industry. At the technology end of all this, kids coming out of school don't just do science, they do technology. They've got to keep our modern science going. And Professor McIntosh says, my knowledge of thermodynamics has shown me that all mechanical systems, such as an engine or a fridge or an aeroplane, etc., require not only energy, but ordered machinery in order to work. Thus, simply adding energy to a lump of matter will not turn this machine into a machine that can do useful work. Clausius and other great thermodynamic specialists of the past demonstrated this in the precise expression of the second law of thermodynamics. Working machinery, or coded information, when dealing with digitally controlled machines such as DNA, is always required before anything works. That's on Dr. Surtees's website, and it's aligned with his demonstration that vaccination cannot work. What it means is that rain cannot work. Because the earth is a lump of matter, the sun adds energy to it, it evaporates water from the sea, that blows over my lawn and rains and waters it. That's a very, very effective machine that generates useful work. This is absolutely dramatic. What the creationists are saying is that they want to introduce into science classes issues that are technologically unsustainable. The consequences of what they're saying will undermine the mathematical physics of how our modern society works. And it's very, very serious.
Thank you. Okay, got one sentence each. Whatever you want to pick up on, the most important thing you think you want to say.
Okay.
I know that's a fair amount.
I think I agree heavily with what Julian is saying to a degree, where this is about philosophy, it's about worldviews, and if the science classroom was immune from philosophy, just teaching science, I would have nothing to say. We'd all be on the same side. But it is teaching philosophy. It's teaching a philosophy where there is no God, where this universe is the result of a kind of godless series of events or an intelligent series of events. And it's only fair to address that in that situation, to say that there is a case also for a God alongside the case for no God.
Christopher.
Well, if I only get one sentence, I'm going to choose a sentence actually from a more qualified person, which is Michael Shermer, who, to put it simply, said it would be difficult to find a supposedly scientific belief system more extraordinary than creationism, whose claims deny not only evolutionary biology, but most of cosmology, physics, paleontology, archaeology, historical geology, zoology, botany and biogeography, not to mention much of early human history.
As a biologist and a scientist, I want to agree with those who wholeheartedly want to teach the facts. I think we should teach the facts. We should be very careful when we cross the line into philosophy, but we want to teach the facts and we want to follow the evidence where it leads. And if the evidence leads to a creator, we should not be afraid of that.
Mm-hmm. My sentence is heavily punctuated. Colon. Look, I think that a lot of the comments are of this kind, which are to do with the philosophical arguments about the ultimate questions, and I think a lot of the ones which are on the side of atheism, I obviously agree with. And I think this is the critical thing to remember, because the point about intelligent design and so forth is that there is no way you can observe in a scientific way that the universe is the work of an intelligent creator. When you put a cell under a microscope, you cannot ever say, my word, he's left his signature there, or, oh, look, he's dropped his tools. It's an absurdity. And that's why, you can never, from observation alone, ever conclude that there is a creator behind it. It's not science.
Dave. I absolutely agree with what you just said, but I thought the gentleman over there put the case against intelligent design very well. It's just not intelligent, and it's not very well designed. And that point's been made for several years now as a counter-argument to some of the spurious arguments put forward about complexity of different organisms, etc., etc. But I still think that what we're missing is the problem in terms of education is a secular problem. It's not a religious problem. It's a secular problem. It's a problem of the fact that we think that actually we're going to try and teach kids to be able to critically appraise arguments of this nature in the classroom rather than teach them what we know about science. And I just want to make that point very, very loudly, because it's being missed completely. And that is a secular argument. That comes from the atheist kind of point of view, not from the religious point of view. And unless we deal with that issue, we're going to completely miss what's going on in schools.
Okay, there's a gentleman who's been patient, so can we get the mic to him? And can I see if anybody else wants to speak? Just raise your hands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the themes which has come up once or twice is people have said that when you look behind what these creationists are saying, or people who believe there's an intelligent designer, you often find that they are Christians or something like that. And I'd say that's not entirely surprising. I've come from the opposite perspective. Up to the age of 18, I strongly believed in evolution. I went to university, and I argued with my Christian flatmates and said, look, you can't be a scientist and be a Christian. Science has disproved the Bible. Why believe the end of it when you know the beginning isn't true? And they argued with my science, and I ended up becoming a creationist because of that. They also ended up becoming a Christian. Now, when you look and you say creationists tend to be Christians or ID people tend to be Christians, you don't know what the rooting is there. If anyone is interested in this theme, we have a book which we're giving away tonight, 5 PhD atheist scientists who looked at the evidence a second time and became creationists, and there'll be many copies of those at the back.
Thank you. And there was a gentleman down here.
Yes, I'm not a scientist, I'm a historian, but I've been very fascinated about Stephen Gould, who's obviously passed away recently, but he wrote once, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as a trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. Now, he was a professor of paleontology at Harvard University, and he was an atheist. He goes on to say in the same article that he thinks that that gradualism, the traditional Darwinism, is a product of Western thought, and he speaks about his view of punctuated equilibrium of a different form of Darwinism, as being a result of, he speaks about the Russian paleontologists supporting that view because they had a Marxist worldview. So what he goes on to say, two things. One, as a paleontologist, he says there's not sufficient evidence in the record to warrant Darwinism. Second, he says that it's a matter of interpretation. You have a bias with it that you bring with your philosophy, whether Marxism or some other thing. Now, he was an atheist. I would like to ask a question to Mark, because he's a zoologist, to what he would, how he would view that as a creationist, because this is an atheist actually speaking. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
The gentleman there, is there anybody else wants who does want to speak before I... Yes, there's you there, okay. Mr. Man with the mic, start speaking.
Yep. Some years ago did a master's degree in theology and science at New College just down the road, and it was at a time when I certainly hadn't heard of intelligent design in the media in the UK. I looked into my dissertation was on the history of the intelligent design movement. And I think it's important to make a distinction between creationism and intelligent design. There's a debate to be had about whether or not intelligent design is science. There's not a debate to be had, as far as I'm concerned, about whether or not creationism is science, because as I think Alec has mentioned, that the belief in a creator cannot be proven by scientific research. It's just not going to happen, because it's a metaphysical belief. But there are many... My concern is that there are many books by people, by scientists, you know, with PhDs from Cambridge and elsewhere in Harvard, who put forward a case for the presence of information in DNA and in the sort of building blocks of life. And what I hear very little of is a response to that that claim, because someone mentioned, why on earth should we have the Christian God or Allah as the creator? Why not an alien? Michael Behe, who's one of the sort of main proponents of intelligent design, said that himself. That what they're doing was not trying to prove a creator God. What they thought was, when you look at DNA, it has information, and that's a scientific claim. And they believe that's based on scientific evidence. But there's very little dealing with that claim. Instead, it's swept away as a straw man. Oh, you're all creationists. And I think that's problematic. And I think that it's dangerous for science that scientific theories are... People who believe they're putting forward scientific theories, their theories have been dismissed rather than dealt with, or, you know.
Okay, I've got two more people, and then I'm going to come back to the panel for their final remarks. Now, there's a gentleman, I think, Scott, the mic, and then if we take the other one, if you could put your hand up so the person can see you, and then I'll take you, because you're smiling at me nicely, and then we're done.
Basically, I'm a Muslim, so I decided to, because I've never done biology before at school, So I decided to take biology crash higher to see what the other side of the story is, because I've been brought up as a Muslim. But you see, we've been taught by mutations and all these kind of things. But I kind of feel that I have to go somewhere else to see how evolution happened. They teach mutations, and then they just jump to, you know, there was some kind of a cow with two horns, and then that some kind of animal with two big horns, and it slowly, gradually changed. But I don't see, like, they don't teach how that happened. They teach about mutations, but then they don't show, like, what kind of mutations happened or anything like that. I feel there's kind of gaps that they just want to cover up. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against, you know, I believe in science, but, you know, I have nothing wrong with the Big Bang or anything like that. But I kind of feel that, you know, if they put that next to it and say that, you know, okay, there are, it's not complete yet, or if they do have the answer, why don't they show us the full picture? Why is it just... Some bits are covered up, but some bits are kind of revealed. So it's a sketchy picture. It's not a full picture. I'm not against science. It's just of these questions that are not being answered. Thanks.
Okay, and there's a and then if we can bring it down to this lady. Yes, sir.
To address the previous commenter, I could give you some good books if you want. Anyway, my question is to Dr. Surtees. The Templeton Foundation, which is an organization founded by a religious scholar, once said, we will give money to any intelligent design researchers who want to do some research, and they did not receive any applications for that. Now, if you've got such good evidence that creation is the case, you could get some money, do some research, if you're a scientist, as you say you are, do some research, and then publish it in a journal, in a scientific journal. Start small. You don't need to start saying that you know, we're all the children of Adam and Eve yet. But you could start small. Start with information in the genome, something like that. Publish it in a journal, and then once it's published in scientific journals, it'll get to textbooks, and then kids will get taught it. There we are. What a wonderful way that would be to do it. Why don't you just do some science, and then we'll all listen to you?
I hope you don't regret that remark. And then we'll come to you, and then I'll come to the panel for their final comments. Yes.
Well, first of all, gentlemen, she's watching, not he. I think that is one of our problems. We try and put things into small compartments that we can understand and, dare I say, control as well. My background is interesting, perhaps. I started in mathematics, went to computer science, and ended up in theology. So I've got three strands. And it's amazing to me how often the logic of mathematics and the theology as well combine. But I wanted to raise an area. Andalusia, we talk about Muslims, and I don't know how many people are aware that during the sort of Middle Ages, the Dark Ages in Europe, we had a fantastic flowering in Granada, Seville, in Andalusia, where the Muslim scientists showed a tremendous renaissance of knowledge at the same time as keeping alive their faith. It was a culture where Muslim, Jew, and Christian survived together, in fact, flourished together. I think in the 21st century, we perhaps lost a little bit of that, and we need to regain that, where our scientists and our theologians can talk to each other. And it's a question that's not going to be answered tonight. I'm also a school teacher, and I tell you, you should be surprised what gets taught in Scottish secondary schools.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to come back to my panel for their final remarks, if I can start with you, Alex.
Well, I was going to thank, I don't know if this is the time, this is the last time I'm going to say anything.
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, it is on the panel.
Okay, well, I was just generally going to thank everybody for coming along tonight, Tiffany, Institute of Ideas. The great thing is to have this on the platform and to have the discussion on the table. And so, what was that?
Souk.
Yeah. Well, it's too late now. If I was souking, I would have souked at the beginning. It's too late now, you see. But my position, again, is that I'm a firm supporter, advocate of doing science in the science classroom. When science moves beyond that boundary into addressing questions that are philosophical, when the science teacher takes off the white coat, when he puts on the tweed jacket, sorry for wearing this, trying to pretend I am a philosopher tonight, and makes statements, for example, along the lines that the universe came from nothing, I don't think it's stupid to ask the question, where did it come from? And if that answer is not scientifically verifiable, if it's some kind of hypothesis, that is fine, but to ask the question and to establish, as many are just blindly told, that it came from nothing, or that the mechanism is unguided, or that we naturally have order from disorder, or that we naturally produce life from non-life, these are significant questions, and whenever materialism, which is a philosophy that bleeds into the science classroom, whenever that is represented, there is an opportunity where the case for no God is given. That is only fair to give the case for a creator alongside that, to balance it. And again, give the students the information, and whenever there's a philosophical discussion in the science classroom, let the students make up their own mind.
I'd just like to kind of come full circle. As I started the evening with putting poor Anne on trial there, up for murder. And, well, I'm a crime writer. and Alex is making the point about us drawing conclusions in science class. In science class, we can only really present cases for things we do have evidence for. The point I was trying to make with regards to this supposed murder trial is this false dichotomy that if there is a lack of evidence for one point of view, does not provide any evidence at all for another unless you provide evidence for that. And I think that remains the problem with arguing that it does continue to assume the default, that the default explanation is a god, without proffering any evidence for it. So you're taking advantage of that default by suggesting that we can't draw certain conclusions from scientific observation. I think we can only teach in science the study of natural phenomena. We can't teach a study or inference of supernatural phenomena because we don't have any evidence, we don't have any means by which to study that. So science is really about studying what we can actually study in the real world. So let's leave that in the science class, real world in the science class, ethereal world in the philosophy class.
So much can be said. I think I've noted down while people were talking. The question to me is, what is truth? And Christopher, I think, is put his finger on it. The real world we teach in science, but the rest we teach elsewhere, implying that it's not actually real. Well, I think that's where we have the problem with the boxes. We're putting things in boxes. So over here we have scientific truth, and over here we have religion. And it was Sir Julian that said, I respect somebody's opinions, but even if they're wrong, they're not intellectually intolerable, even if they're wrong. Well, how can something that's wrong be intellectually tolerable? Surely, truth is where what we're seeking after. And I think that's where I want to end my contribution. We need to find out the truth. We need to critique the best arguments of both sides. We need to keep the debate going. We need to search for truth, and we follow the evidence where it leads.
Briefly, things that can be wrong but intellectually tolerable because it is not so clear that they are wrong. There's room for debate, okay? But I want to just change focus a bit because I think there's a kind of impression that might be given here that this is really a debate between the religious and the atheists. And I think that's wrong. Former Bishop of Oxford, Richard Harris, and lots of people like him are banging their heads against the wall, saying that all this ID stuff is an absolute disaster for religion. Because intelligent religion, not so long ago, you know, no one was disagreeing with the theory of evolution. They'd all come to terms with that. You know, no one was sort of like, amongst the sort of like, he's shaking his head. I'm not saying all religious people, but a lot of this sort of, certainly the more intellectual sort of strands of it, people accepted that the Bible wasn't literal truth. You know, this wasn't being fun. The idea of the God of the gaps, people recognise that was a disastrous idea of God. That this is why, you know, people in, you know, thousands of years ago thought all the thunder's going, what did that? Must be God. You know, the idea of plugging the gaps in our knowledge with God was disastrous, and people recognise that attempts to plug gaps in our knowledge of how the natural world works in ID is also disastrous. So all these things, whether they were the majority or not, okay, you can argue about that. But there are plenty of people who are making headway in the upper echelons of the church, in serious areas of religious belief, who, you know, had accepted all this stuff. Now they find that when people think of religion, and they think of people who are sort of like anti-scientific, anti-evolution, believing the literal truth of the Bible, and the smarter, more intelligent wing, as I'd put it, I'm afraid, of religion is, you know, on the decline. So I think this is really a disaster for religion. It's also a disaster for Islam, by the way, because Islam, of course, did have, in various periods of its history, a good tradition of science and mathematics and everything. And contemporary resistance in Islam to theory of evolution isn't doing it any credit either. So I think that let's not just pretend this is a debate between atheists and the religious. The religious camp is not unified on this at all. And I want to sort of like offer my support to all those religious people who want to fight intelligent design and creationism, not on the basis that it's religion and therefore it's nonsense, but on the basis that it's false and therefore it's nonsense.
Dave.
Where can you find a religious person? Not in an RE lesson, that's for sure. Most RE teachers in schools these days just don't believe in God. My experience of this says this very loud and clear. Because what is taught in RE lessons is a kind of relativist critique of religion, much as what is now being taught in science lessons is a relativist critique of science. No one believes in anything much at all. And I just wish they would. I mean, if religious people would stand up and say, I believe in God and I will subscribe to this religion and I'm damn going to stand up for it, great. You can actually then respect them for believing in something. But if they're saying to me, no, well, I can't say that, but I'll hide it somewhere in whatever place you can fit it in, into a scientific laboratory, I just think, you know, it just shows the weakness of religion as much as anything else. And if just to rub it in, you know, in the Texas, which is one of the heartlands of creationism being taught in schools and all the rest of it, the Texas Board of Education just last week dumped the teaching of the weakness of the theories of evolution. They're losing the argument. It doesn't wash. It's not an upsurge of religious fervour taking over in the States. And I really just don't think that's the case here either. But what we are dealing with is a lack of belief in anything. And when it comes to science, the thing that I would argue is that we, if you believe in science and you've got anything to say about it, you should stand up for what it is. And then the young man over there, you raise valid critiques about biology and what it explains, you'd expect your science teacher to damn well explain it to you. And if that was the case, then you might be able to resolve the issue yourself. But unfortunately for too many people, that we're just losing the ability to do that.
Five words, sorry. Give me that conviction. I'm not so sure.
And with that, can we thank our panel?